thought, but what is desire? A better word is wanting. Desire sounds a bit, little bit too abstract. Wanting gives you a clearer sense of what it is and the power that very often is behind that, I want, which can lead to action, but action that always has that, the neediness and the negative polarity that is behind wanting that flows into any action that is that I want. And so many people are involved in long years of daydreaming or this kind of longing that you describe. There is pain in that also. And it is a subtle way, not such an obvious way, in which emotional pain is also being created through your thought processes, as you state correctly, not directly, but indirectly. And that is moderate food for the pain body. Because there's that not enough me, a sense of dissatisfaction, and there are emotions that go with that, neediness, certain sometimes half-expressed thoughts, as me having been treated unfairly and wanting and needing this to complete me. So watch, you can, as more presence arises, you can watch what happens in your mind and the thought processes are there and see how the pain body can be very clever in trying to get, if it's deprived of food here, it will try to get its food through something else. Pain bodies are looking out, and they are, the media feeds pain bodies. A lot of the films feed the pain bodies. That's why they are made. And the pain bodies, when you become very conscious, so the pain body cannot use your thought processes anymore, and you don't feed it other things, what people consume when they watch to a lot of the TV, things you see, or films, violence that the pain body loves. This film will make you feel really bad. That's what basically it says when you read the advertisement for the film. It'll make you feel very bad indeed. You will witness the most horrible things on that screen. And then people run and go, pay their money. And if all else fails, the pain body may create certain pains in your body. Physical pain, and because it can no longer use your mind, so suddenly you get sharp pains here or there or somewhere, and you don't know what is this, and it can happen. People have told me this, when you place your attention on it, it can shift to another part of the body. Because pain bodies don't like to be looked at. Well, and so the pain body then hopes that you will react to the pain, and the pain could create emotion again. It could create thought processes again of unhappiness, and then it's feeding again. So this is a good question. There are subtle ways in which the pain body can feed, even on thoughts that on the surface do not immediately appear to be negative, but have that negative dimension built into them. A painful me needing and wanting something. That's not as powerful food for the pain body as an anger attack, but that works too. So alertness required, alert to watch. Another way in which pain bodies try to get at you can be through somebody else around you, because pain bodies are connected. Once I had a beautiful session when I was still seeing people privately with somebody who came with an extremely heavy pain body and was sitting there, and who was sitting there wasn't, there was a pain body sitting there emanating that frequency that pain bodies emanate, that a sensitive person can feel even after they've left the room. A sensitive person comes into the room and say, what's happened in here? It leaves that behind. But we had such a beautiful session that in that session, presence arose in that person, even while the pain body was still there. There was a sudden recognition of pain body as the pain body. And in that, the pain body withdrew, subsided, or lost some of its energy field. Wow! There was the clear seeing that that was not him. And it was a beautiful session. He left almost in a state of astonishment, because all his life, that was him. That was his most essential characteristic. Everybody knew him as that kind of person. Everybody knew him as the pain body. That was him. And that was, he left. I sat there for a while. I felt hungry. I went out around the corner to an Indian restaurant. I sat at a table. And at a table in front of me, there was sitting the heaviest pain body I've ever seen. And he was shouting and fuming. He wasn't going to pay for his food. He was in a wheelchair. A wheelchair can be, for some people, has been the greatest transformation, to be, not to be able to move freely anymore, has taken some people into presence, has forced some people. I've met some people in wheelchairs who became free through their teacher, their disability. They went into surrender. The opposite can happen too. It can take, this applies to any illness. The illness is potentially helpful and can also lead you the other way, which is an even heavier resistance. So this person was in extreme pain body, and the whole restaurant was being filled with that emanation, not to mention the words coming out of his mouth. And then he stormed off in his wheelchair out of the restaurant, and 2 minutes later he came back in, and he had an electric thing. The waitress tried to push him out again. There was a huge drama. And he pushed his electric wheelchair into forward, and he pinned the waitress against the wall. Everybody was shouting. And I was sitting there, and the manager came by, and for some reason the manager looked at me and said, did you do all that? It's interesting that the pain body came the moment after a pain body seemed to have suffered almost such a defeat, to be exposed as the pain body, and then it came back again in another form and said, I'm still here. It's very interesting how that works. In the end, I simply sat there as an observing presence in that restaurant. In the end, a huge policeman came in, quite old, perhaps nearing, he had seen it all. And there came the thing that comes when people, he, in his own way, there was presence in him, at least in when he exercised his duties. He must have been reasonable for 40 years or something. He came in, he just looked at him, and he looked at the manager. I said, has he paid his bill? The manager said, no, it's okay, I don't want it. And he just, the policeman, just a few words, quiet words came out of his mouth, and the man became very quiet and left. The policeman said goodbye, he won't come back. Beautiful to see in some people in whom presence may not yet operate in the totality of their lives, he had achieved mastery and presence in his function as a policeman. Wonderful to see. But the example I gave to see that sometimes pain bodies can come externally to challenge you again through some external form. By the way, be very careful when you feel pain body is active in you, then you actually draw to yourself other pain bodies. They will then directly attack you, directly go for you, because they recognize an active pain body. You could go into a shop, a store, buy something, and suddenly the storekeeper attacks you with, says, what did I do? You came as a pain body, and his pain body recognized you. So the likelihood of an accident happening or getting into some kind of drama is greater when you walk around the city with an active pain body, let alone not to mention your place of work, where some people at work in some corporations, some people have pain bodies that are almost permanently active and very rarely dormant. It happens. Beautiful practice, pain body practice. Beautiful teacher and teaching. That also becomes an opening, becomes a doorway. So thank you for that question. That was one subtle aspect of pain body. Nobody had asked that before, and it's true. Perhaps one or two more questions. I don't know, do we go back to that side now? There's some kind of structure here, formal.
If you want to make this one brief so you can answer theirs, that's fine. I think you touched on this earlier when you talked about that fish tank where the guppies were coming out, the little fish were being rebirthed, and it brought me back to this question I'd had for a while. If all thoughts and emotions end with the dissolution of the body, then what part of our individualized consciousness goes on afterward, and where does it go before it comes back as one of those little guppies in God's fish tank?
You may have heard the Zen story. The disciple goes, comes to the master and says, Master, what happens to us after death? The master says, how should I know? This is not the end. The disciple says, well, you are the master, aren't you? The master says, maybe, but I'm not the dead one. The question, let's see if this question can be answered without leaving the now. What part of our individuality survives, if anything? That survives, whatever survives here after this retreat is the essence. That's, I'm exaggerating a little because I'm sure a few other things also survive the retreat. But what we are going to is, what is it that causes you to feel and to know that you are? How? What is that I am? What is the strange thing? There was the philosopher Descartes who wanted to find out, is there anything that I can know without any doubt whatsoever? Is there anything? Because he came after the Middle Ages when people had all kinds of weird ideas and superstitions and weird beliefs. It was also an age of spirituality, but it was also an age of strange mind structures. And then he came and said, what, is there anything I can know? And he thought and thought and thought and finally realized that he was always thinking. And then he came up with that idea that I think, therefore I am. Of course, that was, he hadn't gone deep enough. He hadn't realized that the sense of beingness, of being you, that innermost sense of identity, goes far beyond thinking. It has, in fact, nothing to do with thinking, except that it gets mixed up with thinking. That at this very moment, the question, if I ask you, who are you? Or you ask yourself, who am I? This is a spiritual practice. Who, and then listen within. You listen for that deepest sense of I, of beingness. Not your memories, you could forget them all, or your name. A deepest, just the sense of your own beingness. It's hiding underneath all the mind structures. It is not, it has no form to it. And that is who you are. That is the I am. That is why Jesus said before Abraham was, I am. There's no past in it. I am. I am. That's the formless being. Everything else is form. You could have a hallucination. You could have a dream. People often ask, is that real or is it not real? Any whatever phenomenon arises. Some people even ask, they say, the world doesn't seem that real to me anymore. Is it real or is it not real? Or you have a vision, nobody else sees it, so they call it a hallucination. And you say, is that real? Whatever it is, any dream, any vision, any sense perception, there must be something real in it. The essence must be, otherwise it would not be. For anything to be, it must have an essence of realness. Nothing can be without an essence of realness. The form may be very temporary. So even a hallucination requires consciousness in which the hallucination happens. The consciousness is the essence, it's a temporary form, it comes and goes. Consciousness is that essence of who you are. Unconditioned. That remains here. When you realize the forms to be insubstantial. That is your innermost nature. The mind then says, yeah, but what about me? That means the feeling of identity has again been bound up with mind structures. What about that me? Those are temporary formations. I don't want to give any, really to utter anything here that goes beyond what can be immediately known, because that is all you need. What can be immediately known, what you can know for yourself, and this is the essence of all knowing. Is that? How wonderful to realize that I am not that little limited entity that I thought I was, that is recognized as a temporary formation. In that wonderful play of forms, almost one could say a seed, a potential flower for the flowering of consciousness. If consciousness flowers when consciousness knows itself, realizes itself, the universe is becoming self-aware. Now, there is no end to the questions that the mind can now ask. No end. The mind can now ask, why? Why isn't the universe self-aware already? Why can't they start off with, can't it start off with self-awareness? Then we don't have to go through all this. How long is it all going to take? What's the purpose of it all? How will it end? And what then? After that? It is the mind, what I have said is the absolute limit. I rarely go that far where I say, the universe is in the process of becoming self-aware, which is also not the absolute truth. it would be absurd to expect to understand the vastness through a few sounds coming out of somebody's mouth. How many sounds are there? Not many. O, e, I, o, f. And how many letters are there in the alphabet? Not that many, a few symbols, and then you put them together in different order. You rearrange the symbols or the sounds in different orders. Okay, let's try this one. Or let's try this. And now this is the explanation of the universe. Of course, Woody Allen's put it even better. You can't even find your way around Chinatown. So, that it's the limits of understanding, and not even attempting to understand through conceptual thought what forever eludes conceptual thought, which is tiny, tiny. But in going within, and as space consciousness arises, there is somehow a deep knowing in that, which cannot be put into words. For example, there's a deep knowing that life is eternal, that life has no opposite, that I am eternal, and even that is almost going too far, even to make that statement, because there is no concepts, there are no concepts or thoughts in that knowing. It is a place of simple no word comes. Stopped. And so it's important. Understanding on an intellectual, conceptual level is not an important part of the evolution of consciousness. The Course in Miracles puts it very similarly. It says, I don't know if it's a literal quote, but it's very close. It may be almost insulting to you when you are told that your understanding is not a powerful contribution to the truth. And one of the things you relinquish in that great act of surrender, of letting go, is the desire to understand. And that's you can still try to understand how to get from here to there, on that level, okay. But the desire to understand the great scheme of things, there comes a point then, and the point is now, where you see, I don't know. And that comes into your everyday life also as an end of the need to continuously interpret the universe around you. You don't need to interpret every event and every person. Habitually, the mind does that. Why not let it be as it is, that person, that event, and respond to it if needed out of that space of letting it be? The need to figure it out. Let's have one more question, and if there may be other questions arising in the collective mind of this room. All questions, every question is relatively important, but no question is absolutely important. If you don't get the essence by now, no further question will get you there. So let's have another question.
Thank you. Last year, a very dear friend of mine who had a tremendous intellect and was full of much compassion committed suicide. That is why I'm here today. So in one sense, it was a tremendous gift to me and my husband. On the other hand, it's been very painful. Now, I believe in Chapter 7, as you discuss portals into the unmanifested, you alluded to death as possibly a portal. Is that true with suicide as well?
Thank you. Thank you. I may have mentioned before that the egoic sense of self has built, by the grace of the divine, has built into it self, a self-destruct mechanism. So the suffering that the egoic self creates for itself is also that which usually over time erodes and sometimes suddenly destroys it. The suffering that it creates is also the agent that erodes the egoic self. Beautiful. And so in the case of suicide, the only personal experience I have of suicide is having come very close to it, to just the edge. So I know the inner state that leads to suicide, which is simultaneously where the seemingly opposite functions of the egoic self meet. And those opposite functions are creating suffering and needing to triumph in my separate sense of selfhood. So on the one hand, suicide is the ultimate triumph of the ego in its battle against the universe. And it says, I will show you, this ultimate way of being right is that on the one hand. I know that retrospectively from my inner state when I looked back on it, that took me to the edge of suicide. If you look deep into it, it is the ego on the one hand wanting to triumph and prove myself right in the last act of... It's like somebody, you know, people who are in disagreement with a group and they get up shout something, and before anybody else can say something, they walk out. And this is a relatively mild way of the ego triumphing. This is my absolute position of rightness, and before anybody can say anything, you leave to question whether you're right or not. So it is an act almost of the last act of self-assertion is that, but at the same time, it is also the ego destroying itself at the same time. So the two seemingly contradictory movements or functions of the ego in an act of suicide come together. It is both, one could say, at that moment, the ego triumphs and then comes an opening. For a moment, the portal then opens. The possibility of death, whenever death happens, there's the possibility of going through that portal. Whether or not the egoic entity destroyed itself totally, or whether it can happen that the ego becomes, that huge chunks fall out of the ego through the suffering that's created, remnants may remain. This I know from observing psychological kinds of deaths that people die, because you can learn about death by learning about psychological death. When disasters happen to people, sometimes the disaster, which in most cases is self-created by ego, that the disaster can sometimes dissolve the entire ego structure. Or the disaster can greatly diminish the ego structure. So what then survives after, if disaster happens in your life, you die a kind of death through it, but it leaves behind a more compassionate being. Ego, big chunks have fallen or been removed from the ego structure. It's no longer that solid after a great disaster. But the ego as a structure may survive and could reassemble itself as you recover from the disaster. And sometimes it's enough for one little remnant to remain, one little identification, one egoic resentment towards someone, one self-image of me as special in some area of my life. One little thing can be enough for the entire egoic structure to come back after a few years. It builds it up again. The disaster recedes into the background, but it left an opening. Even the slightest bit left is very much like the robot in Terminator 2, or whatever it was, where this thing from the future comes here, and it's built of liquid metal, looks like a human, and you can destroy it as many times as you like. If there's only a drop left of that liquid metal, it quickly reassembles itself. Ego is a little bit like that. So what we know from what happens to the ego when through self-created suffering it experiences disaster and then becomes greatly diminished through that, or sometimes destroyed. The same thing will happen when the ego commits this final act of triumph that is a great disaster. It could have the effect of destroying the ego, or it is possible that the ego still survives in some form and then whatever it does, this energy field that survives, that was a person once, this energetic formation, nothing is ever lost. Every human being in this room, because every human being is connected to the totality of humanity, and whether you believe in reincarnation or not, doesn't matter. Every human being, whatever any human has experienced, you have already experienced, because you are only the outcome of the whole past humanity. You carry all that within you, whether you believe in personal reincarnation or not, we'll put that aside. You carry within you the past of humanity, every human. You have experienced it all. Ultimately, humanity is one organism, one being, not it appearing as millions of entities, but it is one evolving organism. We place excessive importance on the temporary individual expressions of that one organism. That one organism is the essence of your being. You are that one organism. And one day, perhaps, there will only be one left when humanity has completed its evolution completely. That will be one again, one divine being, male and female in one, the end of duality. And so you being one with the totality, being an expression of the one, you have experienced suicide many times. You have committed murder and you have been murdered many times. And all the other things that humanity has been through. We have all been through it many times. And so it is all part of the evolving consciousness through the human form. Nothing is ever lost. Every life is a contribution to that. We cannot fully understand how. Every life contributes, there's an essence in every life that is the nectar and that is left. That is the contribution, the distillation of what seems like an individual life. There's a learning process. And some of that learning is through human pain. A lot of it in the evolutionary journey of humanity is through pain. And then learning happens also in other ways, as is the case now. So trust that nothing is ever lost. Ultimately, no one is ever lost. It is humanity experiencing human pain. This is on the deepest level. Again, let's shift to an individual level. That's what seems like an entity whose life has not worked out, that is the surface appearance of things. If you look beyond the surface appearance of things, there is no such thing as a life not working out. Every life is part of the learning process and contributes to the learning process of the totality. So we need to go beyond that and see some humans, temporary forms, make their contribution in the form of the pain that they suffer. And perhaps they awaken at that moment of death out of the pain. We cannot know when that portal opened up, the body dissolved, the psychological structure, the portal opened up. The strength is the most unlikely humans are ready for the transformation of consciousness. And we cannot say that this human being may not have been ready. Consciousness works in mysterious ways. I'm sometimes here surprised at who is ready for this. People, you would say, no, what they have done, look who they are, look at their life, look what they've done to others or to themselves. They are obviously not ready, and yet they may be ready. Everything that happens, seemingly senseless events like that suicide, seemingly senseless collective disasters like last year in New York, all those events within the totality have a beautiful place. Every death and every suffering is part of the totality that is evolving. Nothing is lost when a form dissolves. And so, from our limited perspective, yes, certain things look bad. From a higher perspective, it's fine. How do we know what the humans who died in the two towers? How many of those in the last seconds of their life broke through identifications that otherwise would have taken a long time to get through? When death comes so suddenly and so unexpectedly, that shock, how many people awakened into a realization in the last moments of to their essential reality, as often has been reported by people who face death, accepted death, and they report that incredible certainty that there is no death, that certainty, that knowing, that deep peace that is suddenly there as death approaches. And those who have gone into death and come back report, in most cases, that all fear left them, because fear is only the fear of the form. And many of those who did come back from a near-death experience had, for the rest of their lives, enormous trust, because they knew nothing was going to be lost. Nothing was going to be lost. Nothing is ever lost. When a form dissolves, that's all that it is. And the dissolving of form has its own beauty, even when it looks tragic. On the surface, the dissolving of form has its own beauty, and the most tragic event is also a sacred event, and that includes suicide. It includes any tragic event. There is a greater harmony that governs the whole, the totality. But when you are in the midst of it, you can't see that. You're like tearing a little fragment out of a huge painting, and then you look at that fragment and say, what's this all about? It doesn't make sense, because you cannot see how one life fits into the totality of all life. It's impossible, but the fact is that it does. So with that comes a surrender that perhaps can come to you now, to see. Surrender now for your friend. Even now, your act of surrender now will have an influence on that event that now seems to be in the past. The surrender now affects even what looks like past, because ultimately there's no past. Any act of surrender even changes past. So your job is to surrender to the pain that was there, the pain that you still feel and go into that. Allow it to be. Allow it to be. Allow what is to be. Allow what was to be. That is your contribution to that, what looks like a tragic event. Thank you. Let's go into stillness.